Hello, everybody. We're going to get started now. Hope you can all hear me. Now, today we're going to go into political philosophy. You know, the last two lectures we were talking about ethics. Now we're going on to political philosophy. It was interesting in the last lecture when I was talking about objectivist ethics, I saw in the chat, and I can see, of course, I can see the chat while I'm lecturing, there was quite a discussion going on about anarchism versus minarchism, so we're going to be getting into that a bit today. Now, it would be funny if when I, oh, Dante isn't getting, can everybody hear me? Are people hearing me all right? Oh, good. Good, people are hearing good. So I was saying, the last time, you know, people were talking about anarchism and minarchism, and I was talking about ethics, there was a whole discussion going on in the chat room about anarchism and minarchism. I think it would be funny if today, when I get into anarchism and minarchism, people start talking about the theory of ethics in the chat room. And maybe that'll happen. We never know. We'll find out. Okay, so what I'm going to do first in the lecture, remember in the first four lectures, I gave first an account, a sort of general account of Rand's metaphysics and epistemology, then I had the second lecture with criticisms of the metaphysics and epistemology. I went into some of the arguments in more detail, and I followed the same structure in the two lectures on ethics. I gave first a kind of general survey of the objectivist view on ethics. Then the lecture last week, I gave some criticisms of the view and went over the arguments in particular. So here, what I'm doing in the lecture today, I'm going to cram this all into one lecture. I'm going to give a first part of the lecture will be and the survey of what the objectivists think about rights and the state. And then in the second part of the lecture, we'll discuss some criticism. The reason I'm doing that in one lecture and two, I want to leave the last lecture open for certain particular topics that I want to talk about. So what we're going to do in this lecture, we're first going to discuss the objectivist view of rights and the state, and then we'll look at some criticism of the objectivist argument. So remember, just to sum up what we know, the background we need to understand the objectivist view of rights and to understand the view of ethics. So each person is supposed to act to preserve his life as a rational being. Remember, the purpose of ethics is for each person is supposed to act to secure his own life and not just physical survival, it's his life as a reasoning, rational being. Remember, there's some tension there among different objectivist writers on how much they stress physical survival, how much survival under certain descriptions, namely as a rational being. There's different ones who emphasize different aspects of it. But so each person's acting in his own self-interest. So one thing you need to do in order to preserve your life is to engage in productive work. You are not supposed to be a parasite, just rely on others, but to the extent you can, you're supposed to engage in productive work. And so it's rather than have an economy where each person is just producing everything for himself or herself, of course, we couldn't get anywhere that way. If we're to have a developed economy, we have to have a division of labor. And here, what we do in division of labor is the relations between people are based on exchanges to their mutual advantage. Say, when I'm working for someone, I work for the Mises Institute, say they think they benefit, whether right or not, it's another question. They think they benefit from my given lectures. In return, they pay me for these lectures. So this is an example of a mutually beneficial exchange. And the objectivists call this, remember if you read the book, the chapters of the Thomas and Kelly book, I may have reading, they call this the trader principle. So what you're doing, the trader principle, is you're basing your relations with people on exchange of values. You're not acting as a parasite or a thief. You're not taking things from people. You're mutual engaging in exchanges for your mutual benefit. And this is something more than, applies more than just economics in the strict sense. Say, it applies to all your relationships. Say, you have someone who's a friend of yours, you would like to go out with that person. So each of you values the other person. And so you spend time together and you find this time you spend with each other mutually beneficial. So this is trader principle, application trader principle. Also, because you're acting, you're exchanging values, each of you values the company of the other person. And if you follow this trader principle, it's the criterion for how you act with others, this principle, if you act according to that, you can't use force against others, except if it's in response to force. So imagine, say, I'm trying to steal your watch, I'm trying to take your watch, it doesn't belong to me. You can resist me by force, but you can't use force initiate force against me. And here, of course, the objectivist is in complete accord with those kind of standard libertarian views that you can't initiate force. So, on the objectivist view, remember, each person is supposed to act to secure his life as a rational being. So in order to do this, I have to have kind of a sphere of activity in which I can act to do this unhindered by force from others. Supposing I was trying to engage in productive work to secure my survival, but people kept assaulting me. People say when I started lecturing, they started putting their hands over my mouth and pulling me away from the lecture platform. That would be interfering with me. I wouldn't be able to act to secure my life if people were going to just stop me from speaking. So each person needs a sphere of activity and where he can act unhindered by force from others, so long as he doesn't initiate force against them. So in the objectivist view, each person needs this sphere of activity where he can act unhindered by force. Each person then has a right against such interference. So I want to make clear this way the objectivist is reasoning, because this will come up later on in the lecture, we'll be examining, is this way of looking at things correct? They say each person needs a sphere of activity to be secure from force, therefore each person has a right against such interference. So it's from what I need this, therefore I have a right to it. And it's not just, I'm not the only one, I don't mean I in particular need this, everyone need to not be interfered with by others, so everyone has a right against such interference. And if we have a society that recognizes each right, person's right, not to have force initiated against him or her, we'll do much better off. Say we can see this, say, in the news today. Say if we were living in Afghanistan now, when people were, various factions were blowing up people in other factions, if you can Libya, Afghanistan, all sorts of countries, then clearly, if we're not in such a society like that, say, if we're fortunate here in the U.S., or at least most parts of the U.S., we don't have to worry that someone is going to blow us up when we go shopping. So if we're in a society that recognizes each person's right not to have force initiated against them, we're going to be much better off than in the site didn't recognize these rights. Now, we want to now ask, well, when objectivists talk about rights, what do they mean by a right? And here you have to remember, we were discussing this in the lecture last time, they apply their view that ethics is relational. Remember, for objectivists, values exist only in relation to individuals. Remember, we talked about three different positions about values. We can say values are just subjective preferences. So when I say murder is wrong, all I'm doing on the subjective view is just expressing my disapproval of murder. I'm saying I don't like murder, expressing my dislike for murder. Then we could have a view that values are intrinsic. I could say murder is just bad in itself. Just thinking about murder, we can see that murder is bad. And we can apply, we can have intrinsic values that don't refer to people's actions at all. Then we could say something like, imagine some kind of ugly object and say, well, this is intrinsically a bad object. It shouldn't exist. It's bad that it exists. So the objectivists don't accept either of those views. They don't accept either this intrinsic view or subjective. They say values are objective in the sense that it's a matter of fact, it's not just a matter of preference or opinion, that certain things are required for human beings to survive, so that the value only exists as a relation between an individual and certain things. It isn't that these various things are valuable in themselves, but they're valuable because they're means to our survival. So it's a bit confusing because in mainstream philosophy, if you say something is objective, you mean just something like it's true. If they say mainstream philosophy, say values are objective, you mean statements about values are true or false. So if I say murder is wrong, if I'm an objectivist in the mainstream sense about values, that means that the statement murder is wrong is true. I can apply true or false statement to predicate true or false to ethical statement. If somebody had a question here. Yes, this is right. I'm getting that individuals don't have rights except when they're together with other individuals. So, as I say, in mainstream philosophy, if you say objective, it just means the predicate's true or false can be applied to something. But the objectivists, the people we're studying or following to Rand, objective would mean true or false, but it has this additional requirement that it cover a relation between human beings and values. So they be very careful when you say, we talk about values being objective, to distinguish from this Rand sense of objective and the way objective is used in mainstream philosophy. And as Alexander has just very aptly pointed out, on this view, rights exist only among individuals. Supposing I was on an island, Robinson Crusoe on this island. So he doesn't have rights because there's no other people. Evidently, just one digression, a few digressions. So there are some people I've heard this in people lecturing, they'll get, when they talk about Crusoe economics, they get this mixed up and they talk about Caruso instead of Crusoe. Remember Robinson Crusoe. Roger Garrison once had a joke about that. Caruso and Faraday instead of Crusoe and Friday. Or while I'm getting jokes on that subject, you know the one where Crusoe said to Friday, you're late, it's Saturday. But, well, now back to our topic. So I say rights exist only as a relation among people. So they're not natural properties of individuals by themselves. So say in the Declaration of Independence, we talk about unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So the objectivists wouldn't accept that. I think they like the Declaration of Independence, but they don't accept that. They don't accept that individuals have rights as just properties, of natural properties of themselves. They say these are just social rights or social express relations among people. Now, the rights that you have, these rights among people, are negative. What do we mean by saying negative rights? That this means people, other people, aren't allowed to initiate force against you. So they don't have positive obligations to come to your aid. Say, I'm trying to earn my living by productive work. So I say, well, all right, I'm going to try to earn money by giving lectures for the Mises Academy. So if you don't want me to give these lectures, say somebody doesn't want to give me these lectures, person doesn't have the right to use force to stop me from speaking. However, people don't have a positive duty to help me. Say it would help me a lot if a lot of people enroll in my classes because that would increase the amount I get paid. But even though it would help me a lot, no one has an obligation to do that, to enroll in my class, just because it would help me. So you don't have positive obligations. Even if, say, somebody's starving and needs help to survive, say somebody in a car crash and needs help, you don't have a positive obligation to come to the person's aid. You only have negative rights not to be interfered with, not to have force used against you. Now, one exception here, you can get into relations with people, like contractual relations that obligate you to do things, and then you can have positive obligation. Then you can have positive obligation, but you start off with that you have no positive obligation. It's just that you have a negative right not to have people interfere with you. Now, so I say you have a right not to be subject to force. And so it's not just that you have a right not to be subject to force over your body, but you have a right not to have your property subject to attack, not just your person. So we couldn't have a case, let's say, where, say today, imagine that President Obama says he wants to increase taxes. So if somebody says, oh, but I don't want to have to pay these taxes, why do you have a right to use force against me? So it wouldn't be on the judge's a good reply to say, well, but he's not using force against you. He's not saying that you have to labor for the government. He's not trying to conscript you. The army is just taking your property, because on the judge's you have rights in your property, not just in your person. So, of course, here, in saying that we have these negative rights and they include property rights, again, Rand is entirely in accord with the standard libertarian view. However, I want to draw an interesting contrast for those of you, I think probably most of you are familiar with the work of Murray Rothbard. Rothbard is those of us who are Rothbardians we'll talk about people's self-ownership. Okay? Each person owns himself or herself. Of course, this founder is Locke, John Locke. But the objectivists don't use the term self-ownership. They tend not to like it much. some kind of separation between the self and the person's body. So they don't like the term self-ownership. However, even though they don't use the term, what they support is very similar to what advocates of self-ownership favor. So there's no real difference there, except they don't like the term self-ownership. And they also wouldn't say, as Rothbard does, that all rights are property rights, because all rights would include rights, of course, rights over your own body. And since they don't talk about self-ownership, they wouldn't be able to accept the view that, you know, all rights are property rights, which is one of Rothbard's holds. Of course, when we talk about property rights, then this immediately raises the question, well, how do we acquire property? It's not once somebody has property, then you can exchange it with other people. That's fairly unproblematic by the trader principle. You can give it to other people. But how do we get property in the first place? And so this is a question that needs to be addressed to get the objection was true. Of course, they have views on this. So the basic point on how we acquire property is that if we're at liberty to promote our own life, of course each person is, so as long as we don't initiate force, then we're free to acquire land and other resources, because that's part of one's freedom of action. They say, well, I'm free to do what I want to try to advance my own life, and one of the things I can do is just say I choose some resources that nobody else is using, so I can go ahead and use them. I can use them because that's going to help me. It's in my interest to do that. So it's part of my freedom of action. I'm not using, say, if I see some land and say, well, I'm going to start a little farm on this land, nobody's claimed that land before. Of course, if I started a farm, it would be bound to fail, but never mind that. So those I just say, well, I'm going to start this farm. That's part of my freedom of action. I'm not using force against you or anyone else just by doing that, so I'm not interfering. I'm not violating this principle. You can't initiate force, so then I'm freely acquiring the property. So, and of course, property is really important because people need property, at least the freedom to acquire in order to lead a productive life. There are people who, of course, don't have land, and landed property. So people just rent their houses and don't own much, but they at least need some personal property in order to lead a productive life. Now, if you want to go into more detail about how we acquire land, we're not going to be able to come up with too much. They emphasize this point I just talked about, that the acquiring resources is part of your freedom of action. They tend not to say much about exactly what you have to do to acquire the property. Say in the Rothbard talks about mixing your labor, found Lot talks about mixing your labor with land, and then Hans Hoppe and Kevin himself don't like the notion mixing the labor. They have their own views on this, but the objectivists don't say much about exactly what you do to have to appropriate land. They just emphasize the point that it's part of your freedom of action that you can acquire resources. Now, sometimes they stress that someone who finds a new use for a resource can be said to have created the resource. Well, they take kind of a standard example. At one time, people knew there was oil in the ground. They would see it kind of seeping out, but they wouldn't care about that. They didn't know that it could be very valuable for use in all sorts of activities. So it was only when people realized oil could be valuable, but it became a resource. So one reason you could claim to own a resource by finding a use for it, you'd in effect created the resource. But this wouldn't always be the case, and they don't make this a requirement for ownership. You'll find, incidentally, in the work of economist Ismail Kirzner, he put great emphasis on this point about if someone comes up with a new use for resource can be taken to be a creator of the resource. But this is one strain you'll find in some writing of objectives and sympathizers, but they don't stress this as a requirement. They stress more that it's just part of your freedom of action, that you're free to acquire property that isn't already owned. Now, suppose we say, it seems very plausible, each of us wants to live in a society where our rights are protected. We wouldn't want to be in a society where we're subject to force. We wouldn't want to, would not say, most of us wouldn't want to move to Libya right now or Afghanistan or other areas where we could be blown up. We want to live in society where our rights are protected. Now, in the objectivist view, for this to be the case, we want our society where our rights are protected, there has to be a single law code in a given territory. Otherwise, there'd be a constant danger of conflict. So imagine, say, there are conflicting law codes. So, imagine part of the United States is subject to U.S. law, and then other parts are subject to French law, British law. We have all sorts of conflicts developing unless there was a single law code. And another important point that they think is that if you didn't have a single legal code, property rights would be undefined. Supposing I said, well, I've appropriated certain land, this is my land, and you said, no, you're actually trespassing on land I've appropriated. So how would you settle it? Remember, according to the objectors, property rights, just like all other rights, express relations among people. So we need to have all these property rights codified so that we can avoid conflict. And in the objectivist view, in order to make sure that people's rights are defended under the law code, there has to be government that enforces the code. So there has to be an agency that makes sure that this single law code is enforced. Now, this government is strictly limited in power, can't go beyond defense, protection, justice. And the thing between defense and protection, we're taking defense as protection against external aggressors and protection to be more domestic matters. We're the same idea. Protection and justice would be dealing with lawsuits and claims of one person against each other. So it's a very limited in power. And we can see why it would have to be limited, because remember, people only have negative rights. So that would say the government said, well, we want to have welfare programs, so we're not, that would involve positive rights, and that's not legitimate on the objectivist view. That's why I say there has to be an agency enforcing the law code. However, competing protection agencies aren't allowed. So if you're familiar with Murray Rothbard's idea, he said, well, if the market works for everything else, why can't we have a market in protection agencies also? So the objectivists don't accept that argument. In fact, they were Rand was very strongly critical of Murray Rothbard for holding this anarchist view. What she said, what she and other objectivists say, is that if they're competing protection agencies, then they're going to be fighting each other. They wouldn't agree on a single law code, and suppose they did agree, then there'd be conflicting interpretation of the code. They would, some people would say, well, the code means this, other people say, no, it means that, and then how would they settle things? They'd have to fight it out. So we can't have that if we want to have people's rights protected, so we need to have a single government. government. Now, there's a problem for the theory of government that I'm sure has occurred to many of you, is that on Rand's view, everyone has rights, including property rights. But if we have a single government agency, well, they need revenue in order to carry on. The government needs revenue in order to carry on its activities. If it's going to be enforcing the law code, well, they have to have officials to do that. They have to have soldiers, police, judges. So how are these people going to get paid? So if you have a government, then don't you need taxation? But if you have taxation, then isn't this interfering with people's property rights? So it looks like Rand is in trouble. But the objectivists have an answer to this. They say that they reject taxation, so nobody has to give money to the government if he doesn't want to. So then how would the government expenses be covered? Well, these would be done by voluntary payments. For example, if, say, you made a contract with people and you wanted them enforced, you'd have to pay a fee to the government. And people could make contracts without paying these fees. However, if they didn't pay, then they couldn't use force to secure their contractual rights. And you can see, why not? Well, because remember, this government has monopoly on using force. It's the only one that can enforce the law code. So if you don't pay to have your contract enforced, you won't be able to use force if somebody violates the contract. So Rand thinks that people would pay for these contracts. Now, there's a very good question that James Hickman asked, well, what about other things that the government does, like defense, and that don't involve contracts? How would it be financed? How it gets financed for that? Well, I think Rand thought that it would be very so important that people want to pay to have their contracts enforced, that that kind of user fee would really generate a lot of revenue. We might imagine also maybe fees for particular kinds of police protection. But remember, this government, since it's a monopoly, the only agent who can use force in that territory can set the price whatever it wants. It doesn't have to follow market prices. It could charge quite high prices for being able to enforcing contracts, and this could cover all its activity. So what we've done in this part of the lecture, we've sketched out the basic objectivist views on rights and the state. And what I want to do now is go through and see, should we accept what they said, or are there problems with it? Now, since you probably know I'm a Rothbardian, you probably won't be surprised that I do think there are problems with the justification of government. Now, I want to first raise a problem before we get to the anarchism and minarchism stuff. I want to first raise a problem with the objectivist concept of rights. Remember, according to objectivism, everyone needs to have a protected sphere of activity in which you can try to pursue a good life. You want to have, say, if you're pursuing your life, you don't want to have people using force against you, which is going to interfere with what you're doing. And this seems very plausible. Remember, we've gone over this already a number of times. You don't want, you're going to, yeah, I'm giving my lecture now, I don't want people to stop me. I don't want people to pull me away from the video so I can't talk. I want to be able to carry on what I'm doing without interference. And I need this. It's not just that I have a preference for this. I need this in the sense that I won't be able to survive unless I can engage in my productive work without interference. But from the fact that you need something, it doesn't follow that you have a right to it. Remember, a right is a claim that others have a duty to do something. If you violate my rights, then you're failing your moral duty. doing something that you morally ought not to do. And if you don't fulfill this duty, force can be used against you. So it does this, it's not clear why this inference follows. Just to say, well, I need something, therefore I have a right to it, in the sense that this imposes some obligation on you not to interfere with me. I need it, therefore you should interfere with me. This is this point that need doesn't apply. Right is one that Bob Nozick made. Remember in that article that I recommended on the Randian argument, which I think is the best criticism of objectivist ethics. Remember, you can find that in his book, Socratic Puzzle, that not everybody should look at. Now, you might respond to this, but I don't think this would be a good response, that, well, only negative rights are involved. I suppose I said, well, I need something, therefore I have a right to it. Somebody could say, well, all right, say just from the fact, say that I need money in order to decide that, doesn't mean you have to give me money. I don't have a right to money, but that would involve some positive obligation to you. But all the objective is saying is that I need not have force used against me, therefore have a right not to have force used against me. That's the negative right. But we could ask the same question, why you have a duty to forbear from using force just because somebody else needs this. Remember, on the objective view, the ethics is based on self-interest. So why is it in my interest to help you if you need not have force used against you? Does it follow it's in my interest not to use force against you? Why does it generate, does your need generate some moral claim against me? Let's take this case, we discussed this, we'll make this a bit more concrete. We discussed the way the objectivists look at property. They say, well, suppose I say I'm free to acquire property because I need it for my freedom of action. Again, suppose there's some land nobody's farming on. I say, well, I'm going to start a farm there. Then I have the right, according to them, to acquire the property because it's part of my freedom of action, and I'm not using force against anybody. But supposing it's true I'm not using force against anybody when I acquire, when I farm on this property, but why should the fact that I'm farming on the property bar you from using it? Like if you say, well, I need to use this for my freedom of action, why should you be now able to say, no, you can't do that? Even if I need it for my freedom of action, why does it stop you from using it? Again, why does the need generate a right? Now, a better answer than the one that just says it's only negative right would be that we're all better off in a society where rights were respected. So remember, the key objective of claim is there's a basic harmony of interest among people. People don't have any really, if people can get along much better by cooperating with one another in the free market, so we'll all be better off if we respect each other's property. Lucas, if I'm not right, is a consequential sort of thing. We're going to be better off if we don't use force against each other, if we respect each other's sphere of activity, so that each person then will be free to try to pursue his or her own life without interference. So we'll all be better off. But there's a problem with this answer. Suppose this answer is correct, and I think it is correct. We all are better off if we don't use force against each other. If we observe this principle that we don't initiate force, we'll all be better off because then we'll all be able to cooperate on the free market. This, of course, is the basic point. Mises makes this point with the free market. This is the way we can cooperate with one another. But the problem here, remember, when we're talking about rights, we're saying which I'm not, involves the language of duties, is I have a right not to be half forces against me, then it's your moral obligation not to use force against me. So if we can say, well, we're better off if no one uses force against each other, we haven't gotten to the notion of a right yet. We're just saying, well, we'd all be better off if we did that. I suppose we say, we're all better off if no one smokes. That doesn't mean people have a right that other people not smoke, even if we'd all be better off if nobody smoked. So question B, well, how do we get this notion of rights just from the fact that we're all better off if we follow this rule that not to initiate force? Now, the Jesuits might respond that we don't need moral obligation in this sense. They could say, well, we have our duties in this kind of strict sense, but it's something your duty, you have to just do this thing come what may. It's just your obligation, some kind of analyzable sense that you must do this. So they believe, they say we don't recognize that kind of moral obligation. If you say it's just in our interest to respect others' right, that's all you need. We don't need, so they could say in this objection, say, well, we need for rights, we need moral obligations and kind of absent sense. They say, no, this would be an example of intrinsicism. We don't need this. We can get along without this notion. Remember, on the objection to you, it isn't in your interest to be a parasite. It's in your interest to cooperate with others, to relate to them according to the traitor principle. So isn't this enough to get some notion of right? So just to show that it's in everybody's interest if we live in a society where force isn't initiated by anyone. So they could say this objection is misconceived. We don't need this kind of other notion, moral obligation, or something that goes beyond interest. It says, no, even if it's something within your interest, that doesn't generate rights. You could just deny that and say all they mean by rights in the social context is in people's interest to establish a society where forces, initiation forces, legally prohibited. Now, the problem here, though, if they say that, is that they can't show that it is always in your interest to respect the rights of others. You might sometimes find that it's in your it is in your interest to violate the rights of others. We gave an example we were discussing, I think the last time, this example that John Hospers gave. Suppose there's someone who's working with the bank and he just one time embezzles money from the bank and he lives happily ever after. So he's violating rights there, but if he, maybe this one time he can get away with it, is it in his interest? It seems like it is in his interest to violate rights. He's doing very well by doing that. Now, of course, Rand says, oh, well, in that kind of case, that couldn't arise because the person would always be afraid that he'd be found out. Just seems like she's just writing a story so it'll come out the way she wants it. It doesn't seem that it is always the case that it pays to respect the rights of others. No doubt it does in many, not most cases, but what if it didn't? So supposing someone responds to this by saying, well, even if people could occasionally profit from violating the rights of others, like others, at the bank where you could say, look, the person is better off. We don't accept Rand's story that he's always going to be thinking about being found out. Still, what would happen if people took this idea seriously, say, well, I'm going to violate other people's rights in cases where I could get away with it. This might very well lead to a breakdown in the system of rights. What if everybody embezzled money from the bank when they thought they could get away with it? Then could we really have that caused the bank to close down? If everybody was constantly looking for opportunities to violate rights, then the whole system would break down. So we have a class question, well, what if everybody did that? Wouldn't the system break down? So we could imagine this response is very well. Sometimes it appears to be in your interest, not in your interest, respect the rights of others. But if everybody did that, then the system would break down. So, however, supposing that's right, it still doesn't give each person a reason not to do that when it's in his interest. So let's make sure we're getting what this is a bit complicated. Let's make sure we're getting what's involved here. So we're assuming that, let's imagine a society where everybody was on the lookout for cases where violating rights would be to his advantage. So I was constantly saying, well, maybe I go in a bookstore, maybe I can just steal a few books when they're not looking. Why pay money for the books when I can get them for nothing? So imagine everybody doing that. So then wouldn't we have much worse consequences than everybody strictly observed rights? So we'd be all better off if we followed the strict rule not to violate other people's rights rather than follow the rule that we're always looking for the immediate good consequences of violating rights. Aren't we better off following this universal rule? We're not just not going to go there, we're not going to think about violating rights. But the problem here is, supposing it's true that we'd all be better off if no one violated rights, that doesn't give me a reason I'm concerned with my immediate, it's my interest, what's in my interest, not to violate anyone's rights in a given case. Because remember, my action can't determine what everybody else is going to do. So even if I violate people's rights, even if other people do the same and we're all worse off, that doesn't give me a self-interested reason now not to do it. This is kind of a classic prison dilemma. We'd all be better off if we followed some particular course of action, maybe not violating everyone's rights. We'd all be better off as a group, but we wouldn't, even if that's true, for the individual, at least in some cases, violating rights dominates in game theory sense, not violating rights. And so violating rights has overall bad consequences, given that everybody's going to do this, doesn't give me a reason not to violate rights now if I think it's to my advantage. Now, when I'm making this argument, it isn't that I'm saying, well, you're preferring in some case your short-term interest to your long-term interest. It isn't that I'm saying, well, in the short term, I'm going to be better off by stealing money from the bank. But my long-term interest is to have a stable society where people don't steal. So if I steal money, I'm preferring my short-term interest to my long-term interest. That isn't what's involved here. It's a rather important to see the difference. Here I'm saying, it's not always in my long-term interest to respect rights, because what I do isn't going to have much of any effect on the total system of rights. So then why not violate rights? It's not like I'm saying, it's not as if I have a machine where I can say, well, if I push this button, I'm going to get what's in my immediate interest, but it will destroy the whole system of rights, which is in my long-term interest. So here, if I take the money, if I push this lever on the machine, I'm then preferring my short-term interest, my long-term interest. No, it's here, what I do won't affect whether other people follow observed rights or not. So it isn't a question of short-term versus long-term interest. The question, is it in my interest always to observe people's rights or not? So see, in the prison dilemma, they say, well, sometimes it might not be in my self-interest to observe everyone's rights. Now, so I say, on this side, I think there are problems then in the objectivist view that they can show from the fact that people need to have a spirit activity where forces and incidentally we have rights if such knowledge occurs. And they can't, if they say, well, the only sense of rights we need is that it's in people's interest to have such a society without initiation for it. This isn't sufficient to show that it's in everyone's interest always to self-interest, always to observe that kind of life. Now, I think their objectives are on self. Now, we want to go from this point about rights to political points about the anarchism, minarchism. And I think they're on solid ground that it's desirable to have a single law code in society. And we have, imagine my example, we have parts of the United States are under U.S. law, parts are under French law, parts are under British law. It might be very confusing. So I think they have at least a reasonable case. It's good to have a single law code in society. But why should we assume that a single law code requires a single protection agency? Couldn't everybody hire the same law code but hire different protection agencies? Just like, say, with other products, supposing we have, say, you go and buy a tube of toothpaste, and most toothpaste is really the same. There's some slight differences in flavor, but really, if you get toothpaste, it's basically the same commodity, but they're different. It doesn't follow from the fact that really toothpaste is pretty much the same, that you have to have just one toothpaste manufacturer and all sorts of different ones. And so why couldn't you have different protection agencies? Maybe you prefer one has slight differences from the other and you prefer that. But why couldn't everybody follow basically the same law code but have different protection agencies? So then if you say, as the objections were, well, these agencies would have different interpretations of the law code and fight over them, couldn't the agencies reach agreement on what to do in case of disputes? And I see someone has asked, Alexander said, if they reached agreement, wouldn't that make them the same kind of same government? It's interesting you ask that because that's my next slide. I'm going to deal with that point. Alexander is good. Maybe you should be giving lectures because he's giving my next slide. So we're imagining now to say, well, they're different in terms of change of law code. And if you have different agencies and they fight over them, couldn't the agencies reach an agreement on what to do in case of disputes? They would say, well, if they imagine someone assaults me and I go to my protection agency and I say, this guy assaulted me, and then my agency tries to arrest that person. So he says, well, I'm not in your agency, I'm in a different agency. So would this need not mean that the Australian Union would start fighting? They could have an agreement on what to do in that kind of case. And this is the point that Murray Rothbard stressed very much, that the agencies would come to some sort of agreement. It seems much more likely when they do that and they just start fighting with each other. Now, objectivists might respond to this as clearly be following Moses, of course, with non-objectivists, that if the agencies agreed on some law code, they would, in effect, be part of a common government. This is point Alexander's making. But why is that right? Why should the fact that, say, imagine agencies agreeing that they do some dispute resolution procedure mean they're part of the same agency? It doesn't seem like that's right. It just be different agencies agreement. So I think there's no such argument really doesn't work. It's also the case that within a single state, there can be differences in interpretation of the law code, say, you have a single government. For example, in the U.S., we have all sorts of constitutional clauses between the different branches of government, the state government and the federal government. These are all part of a common government. We still have differences of opinion, so having a single agency in grand sense doesn't eliminate conflict. Now, another problem I want to mention, and this is related to the earlier question we were raising about interests versus rights. I was raising the point from the point that it's in our interest and that we need to have a sphere of activity where we're not having force use against it, that it follows that we have a right to that. I was saying maybe if it doesn't follow, maybe there's some problem with that. We can raise a similar problem here. Suppose the objectivist argument is correct that competing protection agencies might lead to violent conflict, and we have one protection agency, we could avoid it. Remember, I just said I don't think that is correct, but I was just assuming that's right. So this might well show an undesirable feature regime of competing protection agencies, but would this be enough to show that people have no right to set up such agencies? And you see the difference, you're just saying, well, here's some kind of inconvenience or some bad aspect of having competing protection agencies, but does that mean we don't have a right to set up such agencies? People, after all, can exercise their rights in a way that doesn't lead to the best overall conflict. Supposing, let's take an example, we say, well, we want to build some highway that will greatly help production people be much, economy much better off with building this highway. Unfortunately, there's some property owner has some little stretch that we need, land that we need for the highway, who won't sell to us. And so we say, well, if we give this person, compensate this person, we can leave them no worse off, so can't we just take the land that we need? Well, no, the person has the right to that land. So even though it would be better overall consequences to take the person land, we can't do it. So just from the fact, if it is one, which I don't think it is, that competing agencies would lead to all sorts of conflict, it doesn't show that people don't have the right to set up such agencies. Now, a consequence of the objectivist position, remember we said there's only one one protection agency, it's just five in each territory. You can't say, imagine we have a limited government in the U.S., one just the way the objectivist one. You can't say, well, even though that's not interfering with our progress, we like to set up our own agency, so we can't do that. Now, it also means individuals are strictly limited in their right to defend themselves. The same arguments that we use against competing protection agencies also apply to individuals. Say, if individuals just try to protect themselves, then they'll get into all sorts of conflicts with each other and might not all follow the same law code. So the objectivists don't say if somebody attacks you, they think you have a right to resist, but they don't think they're very strictly limited on what individuals can do to protect themselves. Leonard Peikoff, who's the Ayn Rand heir and the one who's the head of the main objectivist group, kind of the orthodox objectivist group, has been very critical of the right of individuals showing guns, you really think this is something the state has the right to regulate because it should be not the agency in charge of protection. So he isn't someone, unlike most of the charities, he isn't someone that says, well, you have a right to have arms to defend yourself. He would not agree with that. Now, the last thing I mentioned is a problem with the objectivist view of how the government is financed. Remember, they said, well, we don't accept taxation, so we're not interfering with people's property. So you can't say we're taking things, property from people unjustly because we're not doing that. We're relying on voluntary payments, mostly to enforce contracts for other user fees. But as Novick pointed out, and I dealt with this a little bit before, the single protection agency can charge a monopoly price since it can forcibly prevent any other group from competing with it. So it can charge very high prices for its services, and then you can't say, well, if you couldn't free market, this is why we don't have monopolies in the free market. You can't say, well, I don't want to pay that, I'm going to go to some competing firm. Because you can't, there aren't any competing firms allowed. So I think this is the problem with the objectivist view of the state, that they can really charge very high prices. So even though they say, well, they're not engaged in, they don't accept taxation, they do think they can charge not the prices and people wouldn't have an alternative. Well, I think now we'll have the rest of the time, like my usual, we have comments, objections, questions. Somebody says, wouldn't the people leave to some other country? Well, you certainly could have that, but people very often aren't willing to leave their, territories. People aren't willing to go from one country to another. So you would have a limitation. They could, suppose they just said, we're going to charge exorbitant prices some other country wasn't, and you would have some limit that way, but it wouldn't be as much of a limit as you would if you had competing agencies. How would territories be defined? This is not something the objectors or really anybody else has gone into in great detail. They haven't really said much about how large or small the territory should be. Or it is one point, of course, would have to be considered if people wanted to establish an objectivist society, but that isn't one they really analyzed in any detail. So it's a good question. I don't think there's an available answer for you. I think it would just be whatever. Say imagine people in a certain area wanted to set up a territory. They could do that, but they just, once they did, they couldn't be competing agencies within that territory. There's a question here. Bill Anderson, why Rand seems to despise the label libertarian when applied to her? Oh, wait, there's a further question from Chase. Question for us. Would anarchists object to a government collecting no tax and did nothing more than protect individual rights? Well, the objection would be that they're forbidding individuals from setting up competing agencies, so they would anarchists would object to that. They say, well, they're violating the rights of individuals to set up their own agencies, and the objectivists don't think individuals have such rights. And then Bill Anderson wants to know why Rand seems to despise the label libertarian. apply to her? Well, she, first of all, she looked at a lot of libertarians. She's familiar with Marie Rothbard, who she knew and quarreled with. As anarchists, remember, she wasn't an anarchist, and she also thought that libertarians were basically ethicist objectivists. They just favored libertarians because they just wanted to do whatever they wanted, but they didn't have a real sense of morality in the way she did. So she didn't like them much. The objectivist thing, remember, metaphysics is theory of knowledge is primary, so if you don't establish your concepts in the right way, then even if you have a political theory that's basically all right, it's really, you're not going to be able to understand that theory correctly. So even if the libertarians say, well, we want a limited state or we want a minimal state, that wouldn't be enough for Rand. Rand wouldn't say, he knows it well. Your concept of state is quite similar to ours, so basically you're all right. But she said he has the wrong philosophy. Someone said one commission. Yes, it's a good question. You wouldn't have to pay this commission on contract. This would if you made that legal requirement, then it would be taxation. It's just that they wouldn't enforce contracts for which people didn't pay that. It would just be, like, imagine what would be the case, say you can subscribe to a fire department where you make payments. If you made the payments, then they'll come and put out fires. But if you don't, they won't. Incidentally, in the Roman Empire, that was, for some period, that was case that were volunteer with fire departments, and sometimes if fire started when people hadn't paid for their to the company, they would just let the place burn. So that we've been historical examples of that. Ted wants to know, could people hire their own security? Well, I don't suppose they rule out something like security guards the way they have now, but I mean they would be strictly under the government, and they have to do exactly what the government said. They wouldn't have rights to do something that the government didn't want them to. Pretty much the way security guards operate today. And if the government said, well, we think things are too dangerous, people couldn't say, well, we have a right to protection more than the government wants to give us. Let's see, there's another question about this from the beginning already. There's something on the brand and the fair. Has Peacock ever directly addressed himself arguing against intellectual property rights? I don't think so. I'll be discussing intellectual property the next time. I think there's an objectivist attorney, I think, who commented on Kinsella, and Kinsella's had exchanges with him on got the names for you for the next time, so they think they're very strongly in favor of intellectual property. They wouldn't agree with Stefan Kinsella's point, but I'll be going into that in the lecture next time. Now, Charles wants to know what would happen if, say, how would this volunteer agency enforced. Suppose there was a competing agency and said, well, we're not going to accept you, they'd be fine without. Well, how would the single agency enforce its requirements? Well, see, I think the question the objectivists are addressing is not what would happen if somebody didn't accept this protectionism. They think what is the legitimate thing to do, what ought to be the case. They think that though some agencies have a lot of weapons and were trying to, the government couldn't suppress it, they would think that would be, this agency would be acting very badly. It should be they're doing the wrong thing in the system of the government. So the question you're asking is a different one from what they're considering. They're considering what is required by ethics, what ought to be the case. I mean, if it would just be, the question would be not really, it would just be like saying, well, I suppose when we say that there shouldn't, people shouldn't steal, well, what if we had a gang of thieves who were very good at stealing and they couldn't be stopped? That would be a different question than should we allow theft? So similarly, even if there was some agency that was very strong, the government couldn't, similar government couldn't stop. That's a different question, but should we just have one agency or a competing agency legitimate? But the court. Now, Lucas says, well, if she says competition protection is illegal, but taxation is compulsory, this would give the state power to coerce those who don't participate. Well, she would deny that. She'd say they're not coercing them unless people don't want to pay the fees. Unless they use force against others, the government wouldn't be forcing them to do anything or forcing them to pay the fees. It would just give a very strong incentive to them to pay in that they wouldn't be able to enforce their contract if they didn't pay. It isn't using for, it isn't coercing them, but it's initiating force against them. So, now let's see. Jonathan had a question. Or somebody else in Brazil. Let's see. Yes, Herbert is suggesting that as a group expands, it encourages others to resist. Yes, that's a good point. Again, remember what we're talking about now is what ought to be the case, not what how. Governments in the actual world will develop it just what ethically is required. Yes, I think that's right. The war on drugs certainly has to work. That's a good point. Lucas said, if they wanted to start their own protection agency, the state would have the ability to apply force to competitors. Yes, that's right. According to Rand, you don't have the right to start your own agency because then it's only one agency per territory for legitimate, so you wouldn't have the right to start a competing agency. In their view, that's entirely right. Now, Leslie asked a good question. She says, well, how wouldn't a minimal state tend to expand? So how an objectivist defense view the minimal state would stay minimal? Well, I think they would say that this just depends on everybody accepting, almost everybody accepting the correct, meaning the objectivist views of ethics. They would say that the only real guarantee that the state wouldn't expand if people who were in that, the government officials, were objectivists and had the proper view of things. So they were very much, remember, ideas were primary for them in explaining the course of history. So they would just say, well, this depends on people having the correct objectivist ideas. There's a word I'm missing here. Yes, so John was like, you can initiate for his own response. So they would take, if you're setting up the protection competing agents, they would take that to the initiation force. let's see now, Herbert said, let's get, would it be the agency gets to decide? Well, I mean, that isn't settling the objectivist theory if we decide what, how big the territory is. It could well work out that way. So it isn't a question the objectivists would really settle in their own account of things. John says the Bush Doctrine says that preemptive strikes are rational. Well, that's something we'll be discussing the next time. I'll say a bit about foreign policy. Now, the objectivists do tend to think in foreign policy, if you think somebody's about to attack you, then a preemptive strike is justified. Somebody mentioned Leo Strauss, so he wasn't an objectivist. He had views on all sorts of things that he, I'm not sure how he's coming in here. Okay, I'm missing the mute by the old spirit. Let's see, we have about 15 minutes or so. Chase, you have a question. Would you mind giving your question now here so I don't have to go to the website and look it up? Does Obama get high marks? Well, probably not from me, but are there, oh, now, Neil said, are the objective, published a lot on politics, I don't know of any. I think Tara Smith wrote a book a while back. Yes, she has, I think, two books on objectivist ethics. Now, there's one book which deals with Leo Strauss, I haven't heard it, called Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea, and that has by C. Bradley Thompson, one chapter by Yaron Brooks. That's actually a very good book on the neoconservatives and Leo Strauss. That has a good deal on foreign policy. I don't know too much on, they've written, I think that's one that discusses foreign policy a good deal. But I think that there isn't that much on objectivist political theory. They mostly just concentrate on the ethics. And you can see why that is, because they have extremely limited notion of the state. The state isn't really doing much besides defense and protection. So aside from foreign policy, there isn't really much to say in political theory. And Charles wants to know, how could it ever be initiated? Basically, as I say, they stress the importance of ideas. So the basic idea they have is just getting people to study objectivism and attracting enough people to objectivism so that it will become commonly accepted. I mean, I don't think they have any program for taking over, for putting their ideas in practice. On a particular issues come up, they will sometimes issue position papers, say, opposing government control of medicine or environmentalism, those are issues that are especially concerning. So the Ayn Rand Institute will issue position papers on a particular political issue. Yes, that's right. Rand didn't accept political participation, especially on particular issues. And she was very interested in politics. That's right. Let me see. Chase's question is way back. Well, let me see if I could find it. Hold on. Sorry, Chase. This one can try to get a gun. But what was the question? Chase, I don't think that was the one. Here it is. Sorry, Chase, I missed that. When objectors say it's always in your best interest to protect the rights of others, aren't they in fact saying that even when it superficially appears to be ingrained in the violator of the object, your knowledge of the fact that you obtain something by force of fraud will cause you to be less happy than you would be by force of fraud in obtaining that something. So this may come up. Yes, that's an excellent question, Chase. So you're saying, well, wouldn't you know if you violated others' act that you're a fraud? So this is certainly, that's right, the objections would think this, but would we have reason to think they're correct about that? I doubt that. I mean, supposing you just didn't worry about it, supposing you just did something and you didn't constantly think, oh, well, I'm a fraud. Why would you have to think that? Suppose you just took some kind of pill, memory pill, and forgot about it. Or maybe the sort of person doesn't brood introspectively over things you've done. You say, well, I did this, but bygones be bygones. What we have to do is concentrate on the present now. So I think, again, this would be a case, you write an objective status, but it's in the case where they're writing a story that goes in accord with what they want. I don't think there's, Chase says, he notices people try to falsify, empirically notice people try to falsify reality, don't tend to be happy. Well, I mean, that's certainly something that could turn out that's the case, but I wonder, is this something that you've actually been investigating empirically, or is this just something that's been read off from objective account? I mean, in certain, and then would it be the case also that, let's get back to our bank investor. So he's taking money from the bank. Is he falsifying reality? Is he making some kind of claim about reality? But is the case? I'm not clear that why violating rights is supposed to be falsifying reality. Is it making some kind of false claim about the world? So again, so my answer there would be, I'm not sure empirical, it might be that you're right, that would just be a matter of empirical investigation, but you can't just say something's the case and then say that it's empirically established just because you find it written in books or Rand and Peacock. The falsification, someone suggests falsification, you're appearing to other people as if you earn the money, but you're not. Well, I don't think that would actually involve a falsification because the other, again, let's take our bank clerk. He stole money. He's certainly not going to tell other people that he stole the money. So other people would be justified in including. For all we know, so far as we know, this person is earning money legitimately, but I don't think that involves any falsification, does it? It's just that's quite consistent with him actually having stolen money. I think there'd be falsification if, say, he was trying to, say, people suspected him of theft and said, oh no, I didn't do this, and you're trying to induce a false belief in them. But here, I wonder, it's an interesting question, isn't it? If you conceal something you've done, you just don't discuss it, are you conveying to people the information? Are you conveying to people the idea that it's not the case that you've done anything illegitimate? I'm not seeing offhand that you are. Maybe that's an interesting question. I have to think about it. But it's not clear that there is a straightforward falsification. I mean, supposing it was the case that I've never read a line of Ayn Rand, I'm just making everything up. So you'd have no reason, supposing I didn't tell you that, I didn't say I'm just making everything up, I'm just faking things, but you wouldn't have the thought, say, you wouldn't think that unless I told you that I was faking things, but I'm not clear that I would be falsifying anything. I would just not be volunteering information that would, if you knew about it, would change your beliefs. But I don't think that would be giving you false information. Maybe it would. I'd have to think about it. It's a very interesting example, but I'm not clear why, as I say, I think it's a bit problematic, and I'm not clear, again, what would be the argument that you're not supposed to falsify reality in the sense that they say you're not supposed to. Let's see, we have a question by Bill. The U.S. Now, Bill is asking, well, if Rand says we had the right to attack the Soviet Union, wouldn't his right as an individual be violated? I think there the objectivists would think that as long as they think there's a threat, say, by another country to the people here, then you'd be justified in taking measures against them. So it would be the protection agency. Imagine what would be a case, suppose you think we're going to be invaded by the Russians, the Russian government is going to come over and invade us, so I think the objection would say, well, we have the right as the protection agency, the government defending the UN, to stop them or to start a preemptive attack against them if we're convinced they're going to attack us. So this is part of defending the fight. It doesn't require ratification by each individual as long as there genuinely is a threat to us. And of course, one could question whether we're right in particular in the actual case there is such a threat. We'll be dealing with a little bit more in more detail with foreign policy next week. It's an interesting point. Yes, now Herbert says, well, as long as the U.S. using the government for a cause that doesn't directly protect your right to violate it. I think that's perfectly correct. The objections would say that is that you're only justified in fighting wars when you're under some kind of threat. But they think that if you do think somebody else is threatening you, then you can really blast them and do what you want to them. So we don't accept kind of standard just war theory. That even if you have a just cause and standard just war theory, there are limits on what you can do to the other side, but you can't attack civilians. They think you can if the other nation is attacking you. They say that, well, I tend to be very isolationist in my views on foreign policy, so I wouldn't accept what they say. I think I don't think they're right about them, and that would involve particular judgments of certain historical cases. Have any objectors analyzed the Icelandic comment? Well, not that I'm aware of. I think there was one object with the author of a book called Anarchism and Minarchism, edited by Roderick Long and Tibor McCann. There was one author who kind of used the example of the Polish kingdom as an example of how bad anarchy gets. The Polish kingdom, of course, Poland came to an end in the three partitions. Remember, can anybody give me the dates of the three partitions of Poland? Everybody should know this. 1772, 1793, 1795. So this objective author said, well, look, in the Polish Commonwealth at that time, there was kind of something like a state of anarchy, all of it. No woman had the right to veto any law that you didn't want. It just dissolved the Polish government. But they gave this as an example of an individual case where what they considered anarchism didn't work. And I don't think they they dealt with ice and much. Okay, well, I guess we're out of time now, so thanks everybody for coming to the lecture, and I hope we'll see you all here next week, which is the final lecture in the course. Okay, thank you everybody.